and how they work together to produce the outcomes. The people are the most important part, since most everything, including the designs themselves, comes from the people. Unless you have a clear understanding of your machine from a higher level and can visualize all its parts and how they work together, you will inevitably fail at this diagnosis and fall short of your potential. At Bridgewater, the high-level goal of all our machines is to create excellent outcomes for our clients, in the returns on their investments, of course, but also in the quality of our relationship and our thought partnership in understanding global economies and markets more broadly. Before we had anything else at Bridgewater, we had this commitment to excellence. Maintaining these extremely high standards has always been a challenge, especially as the pace of our growth and change accelerated. In the next several chapters, I will walk you through a case in which our client service outcomes began to slip and show how we used the five-step process to improve our machine. But first, I want to share some high-level principles for building and evolving the machine that is any organization. Principle 10.1. Look down on your machine and yourself within it from the higher level. Higher-level thinking isn't something that's done by higher-level beings. It's simply seeing things from the top down. Think of it as looking at a photo of yourself and the world around you from outer space. From that vantage, you can see the relationships between the continents, countries, and seas. Then you can get more granular by zooming into a closer-up view of your country, your city, your neighborhood, and finally your immediate environment. Having that macro perspective gives you much more insight than you'd get if you simply looked around your house through your own eyes. A. Constantly compare your outcomes to your goals. You must always be simultaneously trying to accomplish the goal and evaluating the machine, the people, and the design, as all outcomes are reflections of how the machine is running. Whenever you identify a problem with your machine, you need to diagnose whether it is the result of a flaw in its design or in the way your people are handling their responsibilities. Sample size is important. Any problem can be a one-off imperfection or a symptom of root causes that will show up as problems repeatedly. If you look at enough problems, which one it is will become clear. B. Understand that a great manager is essentially an organizational engineer. Great managers are not philosophers, entertainers, doers, or artists. They are engineers. They see their organizations as machines and work assiduously to maintain and improve them. They create process flow diagrams to show how the machine works and to evaluate its design. They build metrics to light up how well each of the individual parts of the machine, most importantly the people, and the machine as a whole are working. And they tinker constantly with its designs and its people to make both better. They don't do this randomly. They do it systematically, always keeping the cause and effect relationships in mind. And while they care deeply about the people involved, they cannot allow their feelings for them or their desire to spare them discomfort to stand in the way of the machine's constant improvement. To do otherwise wouldn't be good for either the individuals on the team or the team that the individuals are a part of. Of course, the higher up you are in an organization, the more important vision and creativity become, but you still must have the skills required to manage and orchestrate well. Some young entrepreneurs start with the vision and creativity and then develop their management skills as they scale their companies. Others start with management skills and develop vision as they climb the ladder. But like great musicians, all great managers have both creativity and technical skills. And no manager at any level can expect to succeed without the skill set of an organizational engineer. C. Build great metrics. Metrics show how the machine is working by providing numbers and setting off alert lights in a dashboard. Metrics are an objective means of assessment, and they tend to have a favorable impact on productivity. If your metrics are good enough, you can gain such a complete and accurate view of what your people are doing and how well they are doing it that you can almost manage via the metrics alone. In constructing your metrics, imagine the most important questions you need answered in order to know how things are going, and imagine what numbers will give you the answers to them. Don't look at the numbers that you have and try to adapt them to your purposes, because you won't get what you need. Instead, start with the most important questions and imagine the metrics that will answer them. Remember that any single metric can mislead. You need enough evidence to establish patterns, and of course, the information that goes into the metrics must be assessed for accuracy. A reluctance to be critical can be detected by looking at the average grade each grader gives. Those giving higher average grades might be easy graders and vice versa. Similarly helpful are forced rankings, in which people must rank coworker performance from best to worst. Forced rankings are essentially the same thing as grading on a curve. Metrics that allow for independent grading across departments and groups are especially valuable. D. Beware of paying too much attention to what is coming at you and not enough attention to your machine. If you keep your focus on each individual task, you will inevitably get bogged down. If instead you pay attention to building and managing your machines, you will be rewarded many times over. E. Don't get distracted by shiny objects. No matter how complete any project or plan, there will always be things that come out of nowhere and look like the most important or urgent or attractive thing to focus on. These shiny objects may be traps that will distract you from thinking in a machine-like way, so be on your guard for them and don't let yourself be seduced. Principle 10.2. Remember that for every case you deal with, your approach should have two purposes. 1. To move you closer to your goal, and 2. To train and test your machine, that is, your people and your design. The second purpose is more important than the first because it is how you build a solid organization that works well in all cases. Most people focus more on the first purpose, which is a big mistake. A. Everything is a case study. Think about what type of case it is and what principles apply to that type of case. By doing this and helping others to do this, you'll get better at handling situations as they repeat over and over again through time. B. When a problem occurs, conduct a discussion at two levels. 1. The machine level, why that outcome was produced, and 2. The case at hand level, what to do about it. Don't make the mistake of just having the case at hand discussion, because then you are micromanaging, that is, you are doing your managee's thinking, and your managee will mistakenly think that's okay. When having the machine level discussion, think clearly how things should have gone and explore why they didn't go that way. If you are in a rush to determine what to do and you have to tell the person who works for you what to do, make sure to explain what you are doing and why. C. When making rules, explain the principles behind them. You don't want the people you work with to merely pay lip service to your community's rules. They should have a high sense of ethics that makes them want to abide by them and hold others accountable for abiding by them, while also working to perfect them. The way to achieve this is via principles that are sound and that have been tested through open discussion. D. Your policies should be natural extensions of your principles. Principles are hierarchical. Some are overarching and some are less important, but they all should inform the policies that guide your individual decisions. It pays to think those policies through and ensure that they are consistent with each other and the principles they are derived from. When faced with a case that doesn't have a clear policy to follow, for example, what to do about an employee whose job is to travel but who faces potential health risks because of his travel, one can't just snatch an answer out of the blue without regard for higher-level principles. Policymakers must make policy in the same way that the judicial system creates case law, iteratively and incrementally, by dealing with specific cases and interpreting the law as it applies to them. That is how I have tried to operate. When a case arises, I lay out the principles behind how I am handling it and get in sync with others to see if we agree on those principles or must modify them to make them better. By and large, that's how all Bridgewater's principles and policies were developed. E. While good principles and policies almost always provide good guidance, remember that there are exceptions to every rule. While everyone has the right to make sense of things and is in fact obliged to challenge principles and policies if they conflict with what they believe is the best approach, that's not the same thing as having the right to change them. Changes in policies must be approved by those who made them or someone else who has been made responsible for evolving them. When someone wishes to make an exception to an important policy at Bridgewater, they must write up a proposed alternative policy and escalate their request to the management committee. Exceptions should be extremely rare because policies that have frequent exceptions are ineffective. The management committee will formally consider it and either reject it, amend it, or adopt it. Principle 10.3. Understand the differences between managing, micromanaging, and not managing. Great managers orchestrate rather than do. Like the conductor of an orchestra, they do not play an instrument, but direct their people so that they play beautifully together. Micromanaging, in contrast, is telling the people who work for you exactly what tasks to do or doing their tasks for them. Not managing is having them do their jobs without your oversight and involvement. To be successful, you need to understand these differences and manage at the right level. A. Managers must make sure that what they are responsible for works well. They can do this by 1. Managing others well. 2. Job slipping down to do work they're not responsible for because others can't do their jobs well. Or 3. Escalating that they can't manage well. The first choice is optimal. The second signals that a change is needed in the people and the design. The third choice is harder still, but mandatory. B. Managing the people who report to you should feel like skiing together. Like a ski instructor, you need to have close contact with your people on the slopes so that you can assess their strengths and weaknesses as they are doing their jobs. There should be a good back and forth as they learn by trial and error. With time, you will be able to decide what they can and can't handle on their own. C. An excellent skier is probably going to be a better ski coach than a novice skier. Believability applies to management, too. The better your track record, the more value you can add as a coach. D. You should be able to delegate the details. If you keep getting bogged down in details, you either have a problem with managing or training, or you have the wrong people doing the job. The real sign of a master manager is that he doesn't have to do practically anything. Managers should view the need to get involved in the nitty-gritty as a bad sign. At the same time, there's danger in thinking you're delegating details when you're actually being too distant from what's important and essentially are not managing. Great managers know the difference. They strive to hire, train, and oversee in a way which others can superbly handle as much as possible on their own. Principle 10.4. Know what your people are like and what makes them tick, because your people are your most important resource. Develop a full profile of each person's values, abilities, and skills. These qualities are the real drivers of behavior, so knowing them in detail will tell you which jobs a person can and cannot do well, which ones they should avoid, and how the person should be trained. These profiles should change as the people change. If you don't know your people well, you don't know what you can expect from them. You're flying blind, and you have no one to blame but yourself if you don't get the outcomes you're expecting. A. Regularly take the temperature of each person who is important to you and to the organization. Probe your key people and urge them to bring up anything that might be bothering them. These problems might be ones you are unaware of, or they may be misunderstood by the person raising them. Whatever the case, it is essential that they be brought out into the open. B. Learn how much confidence to have in your people. Don't assume it. No manager should delegate responsibilities to people they don't know well. It takes time to learn about people and how much confidence you can vest in them. Sometimes new people are offended when their managers don't have confidence in how they are carrying out their responsibilities. They think it's a criticism of their abilities when it's simply a matter of the manager being realistic about the fact that he or she hasn't had enough time or direct experience with them to form a point of view. C. Vary your involvement based on your confidence. Management largely consists of scanning and probing everything you're responsible for to identify suspicious signs. Based on what you see, you should vary your degree of digging, doing more for people and areas that look suspicious and less where what you see instills confidence. At Bridgewater, a host of tools, issues log, metrics, daily updates, checklists, produce objective performance-related data. Managers should review and spot-check them regularly. Principle 10.5. Clearly assign responsibilities. Eliminate any confusion about expectations and ensure that people view their failures to complete their tasks and achieve their goals as personal failures. The most important person on a team is the one who is given the overall responsibility for accomplishing the mission. This person must have both the vision to see what should be done and the discipline to make sure it's accomplished. A. Remember who has what responsibilities. While that might sound obvious, people often fail to stick to their own responsibilities. Even senior people in organizations sometimes act like young kids just learning to play soccer, running after the ball in an effort to help, but forgetting what position they're supposed to play. This can undermine rather than improve performance. So make sure that people remember how the team is supposed to work and play their positions well. B. Watch out for job slip. Job slip is when a job changes without being explicitly thought through and agreed to, generally because of changing circumstances or a temporary necessity. Job slip often leads to the wrong people handling the wrong responsibilities and confusion over who is supposed to do what. Principle 10.6. Probe deep and hard to learn what you can expect from your machine. Constantly probe the people who report to you while making sure they understand that it's good for them and everyone else to surface their problems and mistakes. Doing so is required to make sure you're getting what you want, even from people who are doing their jobs well, though they can be given a bit more leeway. Probing shouldn't just come from the top down. The people who work for you should constantly challenge you so that you can become as good as you can be. In doing so, they will understand that they are just as responsible for finding solutions as you are. It's much easier for people to remain spectators than to become players. Forcing them onto the field strengthens the whole team. A. Get a threshold level of understanding. When managing an area, you need to gain a rich enough understanding of the people, processes, and problems around you to make well-informed decisions. Without that understanding, you will believe the stories and excuses you were told. B. Avoid staying too distant. You need to know your people extremely well, provide and receive regular feedback, and have quality discussions. And while you don't want to get distracted by gossip, you have to be able to get a quick download from the appropriate people. Your job design needs to build in the time to do these things. If it doesn't, you run the risk of not managing. The tools I have developed give me windows into what people are doing and what they are like, and I follow up on problems. C. Use daily updates as a tool for staying on top of what your people are doing and thinking. I ask each person who reports to me to take about 10 to 15 minutes to write a brief description of what they did that day, the issues pertaining to them, and their reflections. By reading these updates and triangulating them, that is, seeing other people's takes on what they are doing together, I can gauge how they are working together, what their moods are, and which threads I should pull on. D. Probe so you know whether problems are likely to occur before they actually do. If problems take you by surprise, it is probably because you are either too far removed from your people and processes, or you haven't adequately visualized how the people and processes might lead to various outcomes. When a crisis is brewing, contact should be close enough that there will be no surprises. E. Probe to the level below the people who report to you. You can't understand how the person who reports to you manages others unless you know their direct reports and can observe how they behave. F. Have the people who report to the people who report to you feel free to escalate their problems to you. This is a great and useful form of upward accountability. G. Don't assume that people's answers are correct. People's answers could be erroneous theories or spin, so you need to occasionally double-check them, especially when they sound questionable. Some managers are reluctant to do this, feeling it is the equivalent of saying they don't trust their people. These managers need to understand that this process is how trust is earned or lost. Your people will learn to be much more accurate in what they tell you if they understand this, and you will learn who you can rely on. H. Train your ear. Over time, you'll hear the same verbal cues indicating that someone is thinking about something badly or failing to apply principles appropriately. For example, listen for the anonymous we as a cue that someone is likely depersonalizing a mistake. I. Make your probing transparent rather than private. This helps assure the quality of the probing because others can make their own assessments, and it will reinforce the culture of truth and transparency. J. Welcome probing. It's important to welcome probing of yourself because no one can see themselves objectively. When you're being probed, it's essential to stay calm. Your emotional lower-level you will probably react to probing with something like, "You're a jerk because you're against me and making me feel bad," whereas your thoughtful higher-level you should be thinking, "It's wonderful that we can be completely honest like this and have such a thoughtful exchange to help assure that I'm doing things well." Listen to your higher level you and don't lose sight of how difficult it can be for the person doing the probing. Besides helping to make the organization and your relationship with the person who is probing you go well, working yourself through this difficult probing will build your character and your equanimity. K. Remember that people who see things and think one way often have difficulty communicating with and relating to people who see things and think another way. Imagine you had to describe what a rose smells like to someone who lacks a sense of smell. No matter how accurate your explanation, it will always fall short of the actual experience. The same thing is true of differences in ways of thinking. They are like blind spots, and if you have one, which we all do, it can be challenging to see what's there. Working through these differences requires a lot of patience and open-mindedness, as well as triangulating with other people who can help fill in the picture. L. Pull all suspicious threads. It's worth pulling all suspicious threads because, one, small negative situations can be symptomatic of serious underlying problems. Two, resolving small differences of perception may prevent more serious divergence of views. And three, in trying to create a culture that values excellence, constantly reinforcing the need to point out and stare at problems, no matter how small, is essential. Otherwise, you risk setting an example of tolerating mediocrity. Prioritization can be a trap if it causes you to ignore the problems around you. Allowing small problems to go unnoticed and unaddressed creates the perception that it's acceptable to tolerate such things. Imagine that all your little problems are small pieces of trash you're stepping over to get to the other side of a room. Sure, what's on the other side of the room may be very important, but it won't hurt you to pick up the trash as you come to it. And by reinforcing the culture of excellence, it will have positive second and third order consequences that will reverberate across your whole organization. While you don't need to pick up every piece, you should never lose sight of the fact that you're stepping over the trash, nor that it's probably not as hard as you think to pick up a piece or two as you go on your way. M. Recognize that there are many ways to skin a cat. Your assessment of how responsible parties are doing their jobs should not be based on whether they're doing it your way, but whether they're doing it in a good way. Be careful about expecting a person who achieves success one way to do it a different way. That's like insisting that Babe Ruth improve his swing. Principle 10.7. Think like an owner and expect the people you work with to do the same. It's a basic reality that if you don't experience the consequences of your actions, you'll take less ownership of them. If you're an employee and you get a paycheck for turning up and pleasing your boss, your mindset will inevitably be trained to this cause-effect relationship. If you're a manager, make sure you structure incentives and penalties that encourage people to take full ownership of what they do and not just coast by. This includes straightforward things such as spending money like it's their own and making sure their responsibilities aren't neglected when they're out of the office. When people recognize that their own well-being is directly connected to that of their community, the ownership relationship becomes reciprocal. A. Going on vacation doesn't mean one can neglect one's responsibilities. Thinking like an owner means making sure that your responsibilities are handled well, regardless of what comes up. While you are away on vacation, it's your responsibility to make sure nothing drops. You can do that via a combination of good planning and coordination before you go, and staying on top of things while you are away. This needn't take much time. It can be as little as an hour of good checking from afar, and it doesn't even have to be every day, so you can typically slip it in when it's convenient. B. Force yourself and the people who work for you to do difficult things. It's a basic law of nature. You must stretch yourself if you want to get strong. You and your people must act with each other like trainers in gyms in order to keep each other fit. Principle 10.8. Recognize and deal with key man risk. Every key person should have at least one person who can replace him or her. It's best to have those people designated as likely successors and to have them apprentice and help in doing those jobs. Principle 10.9. Don't treat everyone the same. Treat them appropriately. It's often said that it is neither fair nor appropriate to treat people differently. But in order to treat people appropriately, you must treat them differently. That is because people and their circumstances are different. If you were a tailor, you wouldn't give all of your customers the same size suit. It is, however, important to treat people according to the same set of rules. That's why I've tried to flesh out Bridgewater's principles in enough depth that differences are accounted for. For example, if someone has worked at Bridgewater for many years, that factors into how they are treated. Likewise, while I find all dishonesty intolerable, I don't treat all acts of dishonesty and all people who are dishonest the same. A. Don't let yourself get squeezed. Plenty of people have threatened me over the years by saying they'd quit, bring a lawsuit, embarrass me in the press, you name it. While some people have advised me that it's easier to just make things go away, I've found doing that is almost always short-sighted. Giving in not only compromises your values, it telegraphs that the rules of the game have changed and opens you up to more of the same. Fighting for what's right can be hard in the short term, of course, but I'm willing to take the punch. What I worry about is doing the right thing, and not about what people think about me. B. Care about the people who work for you. If you aren't working with people you care about and respect, your job probably isn't the one for you. I will be there for anyone who really needs me. When a whole community operates this way, it is very powerful and rewarding. Personal contact at times of personal difficulty is a must. Principle 10.10. Know that great leadership is generally not what it's made out to be. I don't use the word leadership to describe what I do or what I think is good because I don't believe that what most people think of as good leadership is effective. Most people think a good leader is a strong person who engenders confidence in others and motivates them to follow him or her, with the emphasis on follow. The stereotypical leader often sees questioning and disagreement as threatening and prefers people do what they're told. As an extension of this paradigm, the leader bears the main burden of decision-making. But because such leaders are never as all-knowing as they try to appear, disenchantment and even anger tends to set in. That's why people who once loved their charismatic leaders often want to get rid of them. This traditional relationship between leaders and followers is the opposite of what I believe is needed to be most effective, and being maximally effective is the most important thing a leader must do. It is more practical to be honest about one's uncertainties, mistakes, and weaknesses than to pretend they don't exist. It is also more important to have good challengers than good followers. Thoughtful discussion and disagreement is practical because it stress tests leaders and brings what they are missing to their attention. One thing that leaders should not do, in my opinion, is be manipulative. Sometimes leaders will use emotions to motivate people to do things that they would not do after reflecting clearly. When dealing with intelligent people in an idea meritocracy, it is essential that one always appeal to their reason rather than their base emotions. The most effective leaders work to 1. Open-mindedly seek out the best answers, and two, bring others along as part of that discovery process. That is how learning and getting in sync occurs. A truly great leader is appropriately uncertain but well-equipped to deal with that uncertainty through open-minded exploration. All else being equal, I think the kind of leader who looks and acts like a skilled ninja will beat the kind of leader who looks and acts like a muscular action hero every time. A. Be weak and strong at the same time. Sometimes asking questions to gain perspective can be misperceived as being weak and indecisive. Of course, it's not. It's necessary in order to become wise, and it is a prerequisite for being strong and decisive. Always seek the advice of wise others and let those who are better than you take the lead. The objective is to have the best understanding to make the best possible leadership decisions. Be open-minded and assertive at the same time and get in tight sync with those who work with you, recognizing that sometimes not all or even the majority of people will agree with you. B. Don't worry about whether or not your people like you and don't look to them to tell you what you should do. Just worry about making the best decisions possible, recognizing that no matter what you do, most everyone will think you're doing something or many things wrong. It is human nature for people to want you to believe their own opinions and to get angry at you if you don't, even when they have no reason to believe that their opinions are good. So if you're leading well, you shouldn't be surprised if people disagree with you. The important thing is for you to be logical and objective in assessing your probabilities of being right. It is not illogical or arrogant to believe that you know better than the average person, so long as you are appropriately open-minded. In fact, it is not logical to believe that what the average person thinks is better than what you and the most insightful people around you think, because you have earned your way into a higher-than-average position, and you and those insightful people are more informed than the average person. If the opposite were true, then you and the average man shouldn't have your respective jobs. In other words, if you don't have better insights than them, you shouldn't be a leader. And if you do have better insights than them, don't worry if you are doing unpopular things. So how should you deal with your people? Your choices are either to ignore them, which will lead to resentment and your ignorance of what they are thinking, blindly do what they want, which wouldn't be a good idea, or encourage them to bring their disagreements to the surface and work through them so openly and reasonably that everyone will recognize the relative merits of your thinking. Have the open disagreement and be happy to either win or lose the thought battles, as long as the best ideas win out. I believe that an idea meritocracy will not only produce better results than other systems, but will also ensure more alignment behind appropriate yet unpopular decisions. C. Don't give orders and try to be followed. Try to be understood and to understand others by getting in sync. If you want to be followed, either for egotistical reasons or because you believe it more expedient to operate that way, you will pay a heavy price in the long run. When you are the only one thinking, the results will suffer. Authoritarian managers don't develop their subordinates, which means those who report to them stay dependent. This hurts everyone in the long run. If you give too many orders, people will likely resent them, and when you aren't looking, defy them. The greatest influence you can have over intelligent people, and the greatest influence they will have on you, comes from constantly getting in sync about what is true and what is best, so that you all want the same things. Principle 10.11. Hold yourself and your people accountable and appreciate them for holding you accountable. Holding people accountable means understanding them and their circumstances well enough to assess whether they can and should do some things differently, getting in sync with them about that, and if they can't adequately do what is required, removing them from their jobs. It is not micromanaging them, nor is it expecting them to be perfect. Holding particularly overloaded people accountable for doing everything excellently is often impractical, not to mention unfair. But people can resent being held accountable, and you don't want to have to tell them what to do all the time. Reason with them so that they understand the value of what you're doing, but never let them off the hook. A. If you've agreed with someone that something is supposed to go a certain way, make sure it goes that way, unless you get in sync about doing it differently. people will often subconsciously gravitate toward activities they like rather than what's required. If they lose sight of their priorities, you need to redirect them. This is part of why it's important to get frequent updates from people about their progress. B. Distinguish between a failure in which someone broke their contract and a failure in which there was no contract to begin with. If you didn't make an expectation clear, you can't hold people accountable for it not being fulfilled. Don't assume that something was implicitly understood. Common sense isn't actually all that common. Be explicit. If responsibilities keep falling between the cracks, consider editing the design of your machine. C. Avoid getting sucked down. This occurs when a manager is pulled down to doing the tasks of a subordinate without acknowledging the problem. The sucked-down phenomenon bears some resemblance to job slip, since it involves the manager's responsibilities slipping into areas that should be left to others. But while job slipping can make sense on a temporary basis to push through to a goal, it's also generally a signal that part of the machine is broken and needs fixing. The sucked-down phenomenon is what happens when a manager chronically fails to properly redesign an area of responsibility to keep him or herself from having to do the job that others should be capable of doing well. You can tell this problem exists when the manager focuses more on getting tasks done than on operating his or her machine. D. Watch out for people who confuse goals and tasks, because if they can't make that distinction, you can't trust them with responsibilities. People who can see the goals are usually able to synthesize, too. One way to test this, if you ask a high-level question like, how is goal XYZ going, a good answer will provide a synthesis up front of how XYZ is going overall and, if needed, will support it by accounting for the tasks that were done to achieve it. People who see the tasks and lose sight of the goals will just describe the tasks that were done. E. Watch out for the unfocused and unproductive theoretical should. A theoretical should occurs when people assume that others or themselves should be able to do something when they don't actually know whether they can, as in Sally should be able to do X, Y, Z. Remember that to really accomplish things, you need believable, responsible parties who have a track record of success in the relevant area. A similar problem occurs when people discuss how to solve a problem by saying something vague and depersonalized, like, we should do X, Y, Z. It is important to identify who these people are by name rather than with a vague we, and to recognize that it is their responsibility to determine what should be done. It is especially pointless for a group of people who are not responsible to say things like, we should, to each other. Instead, those people should be speaking to the responsible party about what should be done. Principle 10.12. Communicate the plan clearly and have clear metrics conveying whether you are progressing according to it. People should know the plans and designs within their departments. If you decide to diverge from an agreed-upon path, be sure to communicate your thoughts to the relevant parties and get their views so that you are all clear about the new direction. This allows people to buy into the plan or express their lack of confidence and suggest changes. It also makes clear what the goals are and who is keeping up his or her end of the bargain and who is falling short. Goals, tasks, and assigned responsibilities should be reviewed at department meetings at least once a quarter, perhaps as often as once a month. A. Put things in perspective by going back before going forward. Before moving forward with a new plan, take the time to reflect on how the machine has been working up till now. Sometimes people have problems putting current conditions into perspective or projecting into the future. Sometimes they forget who or what caused things to go well or poorly. By asking them to tell the story of how we got here, or by telling the story yourself, you highlight important items that were done well or poorly in relation to their consequences. Draw attention to the bigger picture and the overarching goals, specify the people who are responsible for specific goals and tasks, and help achieve agreement. Being able to connect all these items at multiple levels is essential for people to understand the plan, give feedback on it, and eventually believe in it. Principle 10.13. Escalate when you can't adequately handle your responsibilities. and make sure that the people who work for you are proactive about doing the same. Escalating means saying you don't believe you can successfully handle a situation and that you are passing the responsible party job to someone else. The person you are escalating to, the person to whom you report, can then decide whether to coach you through it, take control themselves, have someone else handle it, or do something else. It's critical that escalation not be seen as a failure, but as a responsibility. All responsible parties will eventually face tests that they don't know whether they can handle. What's important is raising their concern so their boss knows about the risks and both the boss and the escalating RP can get in sync about what to do about it. There is no greater failure than to fail to escalate a responsibility you cannot handle. Make sure your people are proactive. Demand that they speak up when they can't meet agreed-upon deliverables or deadlines. Such communication is essential to get in sync both on the case at hand and on what the person handling it is like. Chapter 11. Perceive and don't tolerate problems. On your way to your goals, you will inevitably encounter problems. To be successful, you must perceive and not tolerate them. Problems are like coal thrown into a locomotive engine because burning them up, inventing and implementing solutions for them, propels us forward. Every problem you find is an opportunity to improve your machine. Identifying and not tolerating problems is one of the most important and disliked things people can do. For a lot of people, identifying problems is difficult to do. Most people would rather celebrate all the things that are going well while sweeping problems under the rug. Those people have their priorities exactly backward, and there is little that can be more harmful to an organization. Don't undermine your progress in pursuit of a pat on the back. Celebrate finding out what is not going well so you can make it go better. Thinking about problems that are difficult to solve may make you anxious, but not thinking about them and therefore not dealing with them should make you even more anxious. Having this kind of anxiety about what can go wrong is extremely useful. It is what drives one to develop systems and metrics for monitoring the outcomes your machine is producing and motivates those who manage well to consistently taste test the outputs of the system and to look for problems in its nooks and crannies. Having that constant worry and doing the double checking is important to maintaining quality control. Making sure that little problems don't exist is important because if they're allowed to continue, they will grow into big problems. To convey the point, I will tell you about a case in which we initially failed to maintain excellence, then perceived the problem, got at its root causes, designed changes, and pushed those changes through to produce excellent results. When I started Bridgewater, I was responsible for everything. I made the company's investment decisions and its management decisions, and then I built the organization to support me and eventually to carry on excellently without me. As Bridgewater grew, the standard I set was uncompromising and straightforward. The analysis we provide to clients should always be of the same quality it would be if I did it myself. That's because when clients ask what we think, they aren't asking what just anyone thinks. They want to know what I and other CIOs who are in charge of our investments are thinking. To achieve that goal, Bridgewater's client service department either handles the questions they get from clients themselves or passes them on to people with various levels of expertise who are assigned to answer questions based on their level of difficulty. The client advisor, who is a knowledgeable professional designed to be the interface between Bridgewater and the client, has to understand the questions well enough to know who they should be routed to, and they need to review the answers before they go back to the client to ensure they are excellent. To be certain that always happens, I created a checks and balances system in which some of our best investment thinkers both draft memos to clients themselves and quality control their colleagues' work, grading it to provide traceable metrics that can be followed to monitor how well things are going and make changes as needed. In 2011, as part of my management transition, I handed the oversight of this process to others, and several months later, one of the people in the client service department began noticing problems. It started with one memo, which two senior investment advisors noticed had gone out the door to a client, even though it contained errors. Though these were minor errors, they were important errors to me. With my prodding, the new management team began investigating other memos and discovered that this poorly prepared memo wasn't just a one-off, It was symptomatic of a more widespread breakdown in the quality control machine. Worse still, the investigation revealed the responsible parties were failing to perceive and diagnose these problems. And most worrisome, it wasn't clear that without my pushing, anyone else would have taken the time to investigate. This initial failure to perceive and not tolerate problems did not happen for lack of caring. It happened because most of the people in the process paid more attention to getting the tasks done than assessing whether the goals were being achieved. They had become more like rubber stampers than craftsmen. While the top people who were supposed to taste the soup to make sure it was excellent were focused on other things. Discovering this was disappointing to all of us because it showed that the high standards that for so long had been the reasons for our success were slipping. Facing this reality was painful, but ultimately healthy. The existence of a problem like this one, whether from a flaw in the design of one's machine or from one's own or others' inabilities, is not shameful. Acknowledging a weakness isn't the same thing as accepting it. It's a necessary first step toward overcoming it. The pain one feels, whether from shame and embarrassment or frustration at one's inability to get the better of it, is like the pain one feels at getting flabby that motivates one to go to the gym. As you'll hear in the following chapters, facing this problem led to important innovations and improvements. The upcoming principles flesh out how to perceive and not tolerate the problems that come your way. Principle 11.1. If you're not worried, you need to worry. And if you're worried, you don't need to worry. That's because worrying about what can go wrong will protect you, and not worrying about what will go wrong will leave you exposed. Principle 11.2. Design and oversee a machine to perceive whether things are good enough or not good enough, or do it yourself. This is usually done by having the right people, people who will probe, who can't stand inferior work or products, and who can synthesize well, and by having good metrics. A. Assign people the job of perceiving problems, give them time to investigate, and make sure they have independent reporting lines so that they can convey problems without any fear of recrimination. Without these things in place, you can't rely on people raising all the problems you need to hear about. B. Watch out for the frog in the boiling water syndrome. Apparently, if you throw a frog into a pot of boiling water, it will jump out immediately, but if you put it in room temperature water and gradually bring it to a boil, it will stay in the pot until it dies. Whether or not that's true of frogs, I see something similar happen to managers all the time. People have a strong tendency to slowly get used to unacceptable things that would shock them if they saw them with fresh eyes. C. Beware of groupthink. The fact that no one seems concerned doesn't mean nothing is wrong. If you see something that seems unacceptable to you, don't assume that the fact that others also know about it and aren't screaming means it's not a problem. This is an easy trap to fall into and a deadly one. Whenever you see badness, point it out to the responsible party and hold them accountable for doing something about it. Never stop saying, "This meal stinks." D. To perceive problems, compare how the outcomes are lining up with your goals. This means comparing the outcomes that the machine is producing to your visualization of the outcomes you expected, so that you can note any deviations. If you expect improvement to rise over time, but improvement plateaus, you will know that you need to get at the root cause to deal with it. If you don't, the trajectory will probably continue. E. Taste the soup. Think of yourself as a chef and taste the soup before it goes out to the customers. Is it too salty or too bland? Managers need to do that too, or have someone in their machine do it for them, for every outcome they're responsible for. People who are delegated this task are called taste testers. F. Have as many eyes looking for problems as possible. Encourage people to bring problems to you. If everyone in your area feels responsible for the area's well-being and no one is afraid to speak up, you will learn about problems when they are still easy to fix and haven't caused serious damage. Stay in sync with the people who are closest to the most important functions. G. pop the cork. It's your responsibility to make sure communications from your people flow freely, so encourage it by giving them plenty of opportunities to speak up. Don't just expect them to provide you with regular and honest feedback. Explicitly ask them for it. H. Realize that the people closest to certain jobs probably know them best. At the very least, they have perspectives you need to understand, so make sure you see things through their eyes. Principle 11.3. Be very specific about problems. Don't start with generalizations. For example, don't say, client advisors aren't communicating well with the analysts. Be specific. Name which client advisors aren't doing this well and in which ways. Start with the specifics and then observe patterns. A. Avoid the anonymous we and they because they mask personal responsibility. Things don't just happen by themselves. They happen because specific people did or didn't do specific things. Don't undermine personal accountability with vagueness. Instead of the passive generalization or the royal we, attribute specific actions to specific people. Harry didn't handle this well. Also avoid we should or we are and so on. Since individuals are the most important building blocks of any organization and since individuals are responsible for the ways things are done, mistakes must be connected to those individuals by name. Someone created the procedure that went wrong or made the faulty decision. Glossing over that can only slow progress toward improvement. Principle 11.4. Don't be afraid to fix the difficult things. In some cases, people accept unacceptable problems because they are perceived as too difficult to fix. Yet fixing unacceptable problems is a lot easier than not fixing them, because not fixing them will lead to more stress, more work, and chronic bad outcomes that could get you fired. So remember one of the first principles of management. You need to look at the feedback you're getting on your machine and either fix your problems or escalate them if need be over and over again. There is no easier alternative than bringing problems to the surface and putting them in the hands of good problem solvers. A. Understand that problems with good, planned solutions in place are completely different from those without such solutions. Unidentified problems are the worst. Identified problems without planned solutions are better, but worse for morale. Identified problems with a good planned solution are better still, and solved problems are best. It's really important to know which category a problem belongs to. The metrics you use to track the progress of your solution should be so clear and intuitive that they are obvious extensions of the plan. B. Think of the problems you perceive in a machine-like way. There are three steps to doing this well. First, note the problem. Then, determine who the RPs to raise it to are. And finally, decide when the right time to discuss it is. In other words, what, who, when. Then follow through. Chapter 12. Diagnose problems to get at their root causes. When you encounter problems, your objective is to specifically identify the root causes of those problems, the specific people or designs that cause them, and to see if these people or designs have a pattern of causing problems. What are the most common reasons for failing to diagnose well? The most common mistake I see people make is dealing with their problems as one-offs rather than using them to diagnose how their machine is working so that they can improve it. They move on to fix problems without getting at their root causes, which is a recipe for continued failure. A thorough and accurate diagnosis, while more time-consuming, will pay huge dividends in the future. The second most common mistake people make is to depersonalize the diagnosis, not connecting problems to the people who failed and not examining what it is about them that caused the failure will not lead to improvements of the individuals or the machines. The third biggest reason for failure is to not connect what one is learning in one diagnosis to what was learned in prior ones. It is important to determine whether the root cause of a particular problem, Harry was careless, is part of a larger pattern, Harry is often careless, or not. It's unlike Harry to be careless. In the case of our client service analytics team, I knew that unless we got to the root cause of the problems, standards would continue to decline. Bridgewater's other leaders agreed. So I led a series of diagnostic sessions with the team, getting everyone at every level into the room to probe and find out what had gone wrong. I started with my mental map of how things should have gone, based on the machine I'd built, and asked the new managers to describe what had actually happened. Bad outcomes don't just happen. They occur because specific people make or fail to make specific decisions. A good diagnosis always gets to the level of determining what it is about those people that led to the bad outcomes. This can be uncomfortable, but if someone isn't suited for a job, they need to be moved out of it so that the same mistakes won't keep occurring. Of course, nobody is perfect. Everyone makes mistakes. So it is important to look at people's track records and their specific strengths and weaknesses in doing a diagnosis. Coming out of these sessions, a few things were clear. Several of the new line managers who the top managers had brought in to run client service analytics didn't have the right skills, synthesis abilities, or levels of caring to oversee the quality control process. And the top managers were far too distant from the area and not probing adequately to make sure that everything was going well. This was the what is, the reality we faced that produced our problems. It wasn't a pretty picture, but it was exactly what we needed to know in order to move to the next step of designing the changes we had to make. The following principles flesh out how to diagnose well, beginning with a basic overview. Principle 12.1. To diagnose well, ask the following questions. 1. Is the outcome good or bad? 2. Who is responsible for the outcome? 3. If the outcome is bad, is the responsible party incapable and/or is the design bad? If you keep those big questions in mind and anchor back to them, you should do well. What follows is a guide for getting the answers to these big picture questions, mostly using a series of simple either-or questions to help you get to the synthesis you are looking for at each step. You should think of these as the answers you need before moving to the next step, leading all the way to the final diagnosis. You can, but don't need to, follow these questions or this format exactly. Depending on your circumstances, you may be able to move through these questions quickly, or you may need to ask some different, more granular questions. Is the outcome good or bad? And who is responsible for the outcome? If you can't quickly get in sync that the outcome was bad and who specifically was responsible, you're probably already headed for the weeds, in other words, into a discussion of tiny, irrelevant details. If the outcome is bad, is the RP incapable and/or is the design bad? The goal is to come to this synthesis, though to get there you may need to examine how the machine worked in this instance and build the synthesis from there. How should the machine have worked? You may have a mental map of who should have done what, or you may need to fill it in using other people's mental maps. In any case, you need to learn who was responsible for doing what and what the principles say about how things should have gone. Keep it simple. At this stage, a common pitfall is to delve into a granular examination of procedural details rather than stay at the level of the machine, the level of who was responsible for doing what. You should be able to crystallize your mental map in just a few statements, each connected to a specific person. If you were delving into details here, you are probably off track. Once you've established the mental map, the key question is, did the machine work as it should have? Yes or no? If not, what didn't go as it should have? What broke? This is called the proximate cause, and this step should be easy to get to if you laid out the mental map clearly. You can do this via yes-no questions as well, because it should just require referring back to the key components of your mental map and pinpointing which the RP or RPs didn't do well. Say your mental map of the machine should have worked as two steps, that Harry should have either 1. Done his assignment on time, or 2. Escalated that he couldn't. All you have to do is pinpoint the two steps. 1. Did he do it on time, yes or no, and if not, 2. Did he escalate, yes or no? It should be this simple, but this is when the conversation often gets dragged into gobbledygook, where someone goes into a detailed explanation of what they did. Remember, It's your job to guide the conversation toward an accurate and clear synthesis. You also have to synthesize whether the problem was meaningful, that is, whether a capable person would have made the same mistake given the circumstances, or whether it's symptomatic of something worth digging into. Don't focus too much on rare events or the trivial problems. Nothing and no one is perfect. But be sure you are not overlooking a clue to a systematic machine problem. It's your job to make that determination. Why didn't things go as they should have? This is where you have synthesized the root cause in order to determine whether the RP is capable or not, or whether the issue is with the design. In order to anchor back to a synthesis rather than get lost in the details, you might tie the failure to the five-step process. Which step was not done well? Everything ultimately fits into those five steps, but you may need to get more specific, so try to crystallize the failure as a specific key attribute or set of attributes. Ask yes and no questions. Did the RP not manage well? Not perceive problems well? Not execute well? Importantly, ask yourself this question. If X attribute is done well next time, will the bad outcome still occur? This is a good way of making sure you are logically connecting the outcome back to the case. Think of it this way. If your mechanic replaced that part in your car, would that fix it? If the root cause is a faulty design, don't stop there. Ask who was responsible for the faulty design and whether they are capable of designing well. Is the root cause a pattern? Yes or no? Any problem can be a one-off imperfection, or it could be a symptom of a root cause that will show up repeatedly. You need to determine which it is. In other words, if Harry failed to do the assignment due to reliability, does Harry have a reliability problem in general? If so, is reliability required for the role? And is Harry's failure due to training or abilities? How should the people and machines evolve as a result? Confirm that the short-term resolution of the issue has been addressed as needed. Determine the steps to be taken for long-term solutions and who is responsible for those steps. Specifically, are there responsibilities that need to be assigned or clarified? Are there machine designs that need to be reworked? Are there people whose fit for their roles needs to be reevaluated? For example, if you've determined that 1, it's a pattern, 2, the RP is missing an attribute that's required for the role, and 3, the attribute is missing due to the RP's ability, not their training, then you've likely been able to determine the answer to your most important question. The person is not capable and needs to be sorted from the role. These principles further flesh out how to diagnose well. A. Ask yourself, who should do what differently? I often hear people complaining about a particular outcome without attempting to understand the machine that caused it. In many cases, these complaints come from people who are seeing the cons of some decision but not the pros, and don't know how the responsible party weighed them to come to a decision. Since all outcomes ultimately come from people and designs, asking yourself, who should do what differently, will point you in the direction of the kind of understanding that you need to actually change outcomes in the future, versus just chirping about them. B. Identify at which step in the five-step process the failure occurred. If a person is chronically failing, is it due to a lack of training or a lack of ability? Which is it? At which of the five steps did the person fail? Different steps require different abilities, and if you can identify which abilities are lacking, you'll go a long way toward diagnosing the problem. C. Identify the principles that were violated. Identify which principles apply to the case at hand, review them, and see if they would have helped. Think for yourself which principles are best for handling similar cases. This will help solve not only this problem, but other problems like it. D. Avoid Monday morning quarterbacking. Evaluate the merits of a past decision based not on what you know now, but only on what you could have reasonably known at the time the decision was made. Every decision has pros and cons. You can't evaluate choices in retrospect without the appropriate context. Do this by asking yourself, what should a quality person have known and done in that situation? Also, have a deep understanding of the person who made the decision, how they think, the type of person they are, whether they learned from the situation, and so on. E. Don't confuse the quality of someone's circumstances with the quality of their approach to dealing with the circumstances. One can be good, and the other can be bad, and it's easy to confuse which is which. Such confusion is especially common in organizations that are doing new things and evolving fast, but haven't yet gotten the kinks out. I've always described Bridgewater as being terrible and terrific at the same time. For nearly 40 years, we have consistently produced extraordinary results while struggling with lots of problems. It is easy to look at messy circumstances, think things must be terrible, and get frustrated. But the real challenge is to look at the long-term successes these messy circumstances have produced and understand how essential they are to the evolutionary process of innovation. F. Identifying the fact that someone else doesn't know what to do doesn't mean that you know what to do. It's one thing to point out a problem. It's another to have an accurate diagnosis and a quality solution. As described earlier, the litmus test for a good problem solver is, 1, they are able to logically describe how to handle the problem, and 2, they have successfully solved similar problems in the past. G. Remember that a root cause is not an action, but a reason. Root causes are described in adjectives, not verbs, so keep asking why to get at them. Since most things are done or not done because someone decided to do them or not to do them in a certain way, most root causes can be traced to specific people who have specific patterns of behavior. Of course, a normally reliable person can make the occasional error, and if that's the case, then it can be forgiven. But when a problem is attributable to a person, you have to ask why they made the mistake, and you have to be as accurate in diagnosing a fault in a person as you would be if he or she were a piece of equipment. A root cause discovery process might proceed like this. The problem was due to bad programming. Why was there bad programming? Because Harry programmed it badly. Why did Harry program it badly? Because he wasn't well trained and because he was in a rush. Why wasn't he well trained? Did his manager know that he wasn't well trained and let him do the job anyway, or did he not know? Consider how personal the questioning is. It doesn't stop at because Harry programmed it badly. You must go deeper in order to understand what about the people and/or design led to the failure. This is difficult for both the diagnoser and the RPs, and it often results in people bringing up all kinds of irrelevant details. Be on your guard, because people will often look to cover themselves by diving into the weeds. H. To distinguish between a capacity issue and a capability issue, imagine how the person would perform at that particular function if they had ample capacity. Think back on how the person performed in similar functions when they had ample capacity. If the same kinds of problems came up, then the problem is very likely one of capabilities. I. Keep in mind that managers usually fail or fall short of their goals for one or more of five reasons. 1. They are too distant. 2. They have problems perceiving bad quality. 3. They have lost sight of how bad things have become because they have gotten used to it. 4. They have such high pride in their work or such large egos that they can't bear to admit they are unable to solve their own problems. 5. They fear adverse consequences from admitting failure. Principle 12.2. Maintain an emerging synthesis by diagnosing continuously. If you don't look into significant bad outcomes as they occur, you won't be able to understand what things they are symptomatic of or how they are changing through time. That is, are they getting better or worse? Principle 12.3. Keep in mind that diagnoses should produce outcomes. If they don't, there's no purpose to them. At a minimum, a diagnosis should take the form of theories about root causes and clarity about what information needs to be gathered to find out more. At best, it should lead directly to a plan or design to fix the problem or problems. A. Remember that if you have the same people doing the same things, you should expect the same results. Einstein defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. Don't fall into this trap because you'll have a hard time getting out of it. Principle 12.4. Use the drill-down technique to gain an 80-20 understanding of a department or subdepartment that is having problems. A drill-down is a process that allows you to gain an understanding of the root causes of the biggest problems in a department or area so you can design a plan to make the area excellent. Drill-downs are not diagnoses, but a form of broad and deep probing. They are not intended to uncover the causes of every problem. Only the 20 or so percent of causes that produce 80% of the suboptimal effects. A drill down takes place in two steps and is then followed by design and execution steps. If done well, the two drill down steps can be done in about 4 hours. It is very important that the steps be done separately and independently so as not to go in too many directions at once. Let me take you through the drill down process, offering guidance and examples for each step. Step 1. List the problems. Quickly inventory all the core problems. Be very specific, as this is the only way to effectively find solutions. Don't generalize or use the third person. Name the names of the people experiencing the problems. Have all the relevant people from the area under scrutiny participate in the drill down. You will benefit from their insights and it will drive their ownership of the solution. Don't focus on rare events or the trivial problems. Nothing is perfect, but be sure they are not symptoms of systematic machine problems. Don't try to find solutions yet. Your focus in this step is strictly on listing the problems. Step 2. Identify the root causes. For each problem, identify the deep-seated reason behind the actions that caused each problem. Most problems happen for one of two reasons. 1. It isn't clear who the responsible party is, or 2. The responsible party isn't handling his or her responsibilities well. You must distinguish proximate causes from root causes. Proximate causes are the reasons or actions that led to the problem. When you start describing the qualities behind these reasons or actions, you are getting closer to the root cause. To get at the root cause, keep asking why. For example, problem. The team is continually working late and is on the verge of burning out. Why? Because we don't have enough capacity to meet the demand put on the team. Why? Because we inherited this new responsibility without additional staff. Why? Because the manager did not understand the volume of work before accepting the responsibility. Why? Because the manager is bad at anticipating problems and creating plans. Root cause. Do not exclude any relevant people from the drill down. Besides losing the benefit of their ideas, you'll disenfranchise them from the game plan and reduce their sense of ownership. At the same time, remember that people tend to be more defensive than self-critical. It is your job as a manager to get at truth and excellence, not to make people happy. For example, the correct path might be to fire some people and replace them with better people, or put them in jobs they might not want. Everyone's objective must be to get at the best answers, not the answers that will make the most people happy. You may find that multiple problems identified in step one share the same root cause. Because you are doing a drill down in a quick session, your root cause diagnoses may only be provisional, essentially alerts about things to watch out for. When step two is completed, take a break to reflect. Then come up with a plan. Step 3. Create a plan. Step away from the group and develop a plan that addresses the root causes. Plans are like movie scripts where you visualize who will do what through time to achieve goals. They are developed by iterating through multiple possibilities, weighing the likelihood of goal achievement versus costs and risks. They should have specific tasks, outcomes, responsible parties, tracking metrics and timelines. Allow the key people involved to discuss the plan thoroughly. Not everyone needs to agree on the plan, but the responsible parties and other key people must be in sync. Step 4. Execute the plan. Execute the agreed-upon plan and transparently track its progress. At least monthly, report on the planned and actual progress to date and the expectations for the coming period, and hold people publicly accountable for delivering their outcomes successfully and on time. Make adjustments to the plan as required to reflect reality. Principle 12.5. Understand that diagnosis is foundational to both progress and quality relationships. If you and others are open-minded and engage in a quality back and forth, not only will you find better solutions, you will also get to know each other better. It is an opportunity for you to assess your people and to help them grow, and vice versa. Chapter 13. Design improvements to your machine to get around your problems. Once you've successfully diagnosed the problem standing in the way of your achieving your goals, you need to design paths for solving them. Designs need to be based on deep and accurate understandings, which is why diagnosis is so important. For me, it's an almost visceral process of staring at problems and using the pain they cause me to stimulate my creative thinking. This is exactly how it was for the team responsible for client service analytics, and especially for Bridgewater's co-CEO, David McCormick, who was then head of the client service department. Coming out of the diagnosis, he moved quickly to design and implement changes. He fired the team members who had allowed standards to slip and reflected deeply on what new designs he could implement to get the right people into the right roles. In selecting his new responsible parties for client service analytics, he picked one of our top investment thinkers who also had extremely high standards and was very outspoken about cases where he saw them slipping, and paired him with one of our most experienced managers, who knew how to build the right process flows and make sure everything that needed to happen would go precisely as planned. But that wasn't all. When coming up with a design, it's important to take time to reflect and make sure you're looking at the problems from the highest level. David knew it would be a mistake to look only at this one part of the department, because the same slip in quality that had happened there was likely to have occurred in other places too. He needed to think creatively to come up with a design that would build a durable culture of pervasive excellence throughout the entire department. This led to his invention of Quality Day, biannual meetings in which members of the client service department would review each other's mock presentations and memos and give direct feedback on what was good and what wasn't. More importantly, the meetings were a chance to step back and assess whether the ways of ensuring quality were working as expected by bringing in a bunch of tough, independent thinkers to offer criticism and get the process realigned on what good looks like. Of course, there were many more details to all of David's plans for transforming the department, but the important thing is how all the details and plans extended from a high-level visualization of what was required. Only when you have such a sketch can you begin to fill it in with specifics. Those specifics will be your tasks. Write them down so you don't forget them. While the best designs are drawn from a rich understanding of actual problems, when you're just starting out on something, you often have a design based on anticipated problems as opposed to actual ones. That's why having systematic ways of tracking issues, the issue log, and what people are like, the dot collector, is so useful. Instead of just relying on your best guesses of what might go wrong, you can look at data from prior at-bats for yourself and others and come to the design process with understanding rather than having to start from scratch. The most talented designers I know are people who can visualize over time, running through different collections of people from the scale of small teams to entire organizations, accurately anticipating the kinds of results they'll produce. They excel at design and systemization, hence the overriding principle of this chapter. Design and systemize your machine. Creativity is also important to this process, as is character, because the most important problems to design around are often the hardest, and you need to come up with original ways of addressing them and be willing to make hard choices, especially when it comes to people and who should do what. These principles delve into designing and how to do it well. Principle 13.1. Build your machine. Focus on each task or case at hand and you will be stuck with them one by one. Instead, build a machine by doing, observing what you're doing and why, extrapolating the relevant principles from the cases at hand and systemizing that process. It typically takes about twice as long to build a machine as it does to resolve the task at hand, but it pays off many times over because the learning and efficiency compound into the future.